she thought wildly. I was riding on a motorcycle all day long, every day. Sure, I took care to clean up every chance I got, but your hands get dirty and... She put out her hand, not at all surprised to see that it was shaking badly. She put her thumb on the smudge. The smudge was a lot bigger. And it wasn't grease or oil. There was no use even kidding herself that it was. It was dried chocolate. Paydays, Franny thought sickly. For a moment she was afraid to do so much as turn around, afraid that she might see Harold's grin hanging over her shoulder like the grin of the Cheshire Cat in Alice. Harold's thick lips moving as he said solemnly, "Every dog has his day, Franny. Every dog has his day." But even if Harold had sneaked a glance into her diary, did it have to mean he was contemplating some secret vendetta against her or Stu or any of the others? Of course not. "But Harold's changed," an interior voice whispered. "God damn it, he hasn't changed that much," she cried to the empty room. She flinched a little at the sound of her own voice, then laughed shakily. She went downstairs and began to get supper. They would be eating early because of the meeting. But suddenly, the meeting didn't seem as important as it had earlier. Excerpts from the minutes of the ad hoc committee meeting, August 13th, 1980. The meeting was held in the apartment of Stu Redman and Francis Goldsmith. All members of the ad hoc committee were present, those being Stuart Redman, Francis Goldsmith, Nick Andros, Glenn Bateman, Ralph Brentner, Susan Stern, and Larry Underwood. Stu Redman was elected moderator of the meeting. Francis Goldsmith was elected recording secretary. These notes, plus complete coverage of every burp, gurgle, and aside, all recorded on Memorex cassettes for anyone crazy enough to want to listen to them, will be placed in a safe deposit box of the First Bank of Boulder. Stu Redman presented a broadside on the subject of food poisoning, written by Dick Ellis and Laurie Constable, eye-catchingly titled, "If You Eat, You Should Read This." He said Dick wanted to see it printed and nailed up all over Boulder before the big meeting on August 18th, because there have already been 15 cases of food poisoning in Boulder, two of them quite serious. The committee voted 7-0 that Ralph should duplicate 1,000 copies of Dick's poster and get 10 people to help him put them up all over town. Susan Stern then presented another item that Dick and Laurie wanted to put before the meeting. We all wished one or the other of them could have been here. They both feel that there must be a burial committee. Dick's idea was that it should be put on the agenda of the public meeting and that it be presented not as a health hazard, because of the possibility it might cause panic, but as the decent thing to do. We all know there are surprisingly few corpses in Boulder in proportion to its pre-plague population, but we don't know why, not that it matters much now. But there are still thousands of dead bodies, and they must be gotten rid of if we intend to stay here. Stu asked how serious the problem was at present, and Sue said she thought it would not become really serious until fall, when the dry, hot weather usually turns damp. Larry Underwood made a motion that we add Dick's suggestion that a burial committee be formed to the agenda of the August 18th meeting. The motion was carried 7-0. Nick Andros was then recognized, and Ralph Brentner read his prepared comments, which I am here quoting verbatim. "One of the most important questions this committee must deal with is whether or not it will agree to take Mother Abigail into its complete confidence, and shall she be told about everything that goes on at our meetings, both open and closed? The question can also be put the other way. Shall Mother Abigail agree to take this committee, and the permanent committee that will follow it, into her complete confidence, and shall the committee be told about all that goes on in her meetings with God or whoever, particularly the closed ones?" That may sound like gibberish, but let me explain, because it's really a pragmatic question. We have to settle Mother Abigail's place in the community right away, because our problem is not just one of getting on our feet again. If that was all, we wouldn't really need her in the first place. As we all know, there is another problem, that of the man we sometimes call the dark man, or as Glenn puts it, the adversary. My proof for his existence is very simple, and I think most people in Boulder will agree with my reasoning, if they wanted to think of it at all. Here it is. I dreamed of Mother Abigail, and she was. I dreamed of the dark man, and therefore he must be, although I have never seen him. The people here love Mother Abigail, and I love her myself. But we won't get far, in fact, we won't get anywhere, if we don't start off with her approval of what we're doing. So this early afternoon, I went to see the lady and put the question to her directly, with all the bark on it. Will you go along? She said that she would, but not without conditions. She was perfectly blunt. She said we should be perfectly free to guide the community in all worldly matters, her phrase, clearing the streets, allocating housing, getting the power back on. But she was also very clear about wanting to be consulted on all matters that have to do with the dark man. She believes we are all a part of a chess game between God and Satan, that Satan's chief agent in this game is the adversary, whose name, she says, is Randall Flagg. The name he's using this time is how she puts it. That for reasons best known to himself, God has chosen her as his agent in this matter. She believes, and in this I happen to agree with her, that a struggle is coming, and it's going to be us or him. She thinks this struggle is the most important thing, and she's adamant about being consulted. Now, I don't want to get into the religious implications of all this, or argue whether she's right or wrong, but it should be obvious that all implications aside, we have a situation we must cope with. So I have a series of motions. There was some discussion of Nick's statement. Nick made this motion. Can we as a committee agree not to discuss the theological, religious, or supernatural implications of the adversary matter during our meetings? By a 7-0 vote, the committee agreed to bar discussion on those matters at least while we are in session. Nick then made this motion. Can we agree that the main private secret business of the committee is the question of how to deal with this force known as the dark man, the adversary, or Randall Flagg? Glenn Bateman seconded the motion, adding that from time to time there might be other business, such as the real reason for the burial committee, that we should keep close to the vest. The motion carried 7-0. Nick then made his original motion that we keep Mother Abigail informed of all public and private business transacted by the committee. That motion was also passed 7-0. Having disposed of the Mother Abigail business for the time being, the committee then moved on to the question of the dark man himself at Nick's request. He proposed that we send 3 volunteers west to join the dark man's people, the purpose being to gain intelligence about what's really going on over there. Sue Stern immediately volunteered. After some hot discussion of that, Glenn Bateman was recognized by Stu and put this motion on the floor. Resolved that no one from our ad hoc committee or from the permanent committee be eligible to volunteer for this reconnaissance. Sue Stern wanted to know why not. Glenn. Everyone respects your honest desire to help, Susan, but the fact is we simply don't know if the people we send will ever come back, or when, or in what shape. In the meantime, we have the not-so-inconsiderable job of getting things in Boulder on a paying basis, if you'll pardon the slang. If you go, we'll have to fill your seat with someone who would have to be briefed on the ground we've already covered. I just don't think we can afford all that lost time. With some reluctance, Sue went along with Glenn's motion, which was carried, gloomily, by a 7-0 vote. Fran Goldsmith then asked Nick what sort of qualifications we should look for in prospective undercover agents and what we should expect them to find out. Nick. We won't know what there is to be learned until they come back. If they do come back. The point is, we have absolutely no idea what he's up to over there. We're more or less like fishermen using human bait. Stu said he thought the committee should pick the people it wanted to ask, and there was general agreement on this. The nominations of our 3 potential spies occupied the rest of the committee's time. Coming to bed, Stu?
Yeah, is it late?
Almost midnight. Late enough. Stu came in from the balcony. He was wearing jockey shorts and nothing else. Their whiteness was nearly dazzling against his tanned skin. She found herself amazed again by the confident depth of her love for him. Thinking about the meeting? She asked him.
Yes, I was.
He poured himself a glass of water from the pitcher on the night table and grimaced at the flat, boiled taste. I thought you made a wonderful moderator. Glenn asked if you'd do it at the public meeting, didn't he? Is it bothering you? Did you decline?
No, I said I would. I guess I can do that. I was thinking about sending those 3 across the mountains. It's a dirty business sending out spies. You were right, Franny. Only trouble is, Nick was right, too. In a case like that, what you going to do? Vote your conscience and then get the best night's sleep you can, I guess. She reached out to touch the Coleman lamp switch. Ready for the light?
Yeah.
She put it out and he swung into bed beside her. Good night, Franny, he said. I love you. She lay looking at the ceiling. The smudged chocolate thumbprint stayed on her mind. Every dog has its day, Fran. Maybe I ought to tell Stu right now, she thought. But if there was a problem, it was her problem. She would just have to wait.
Watch, and see if anything happened.
It was a long time before she slept. Chapter 42. In the early hours of the morning, Mother Abigail lay sleepless in her bed. She was trying to pray. She got up without making a light and knelt down in her white cotton nightgown. She pressed her forehead to her Bible, which was open to the Acts of the Apostles. The conversion of doer old Saul on the Damascus Road. He had been blinded by the light, and on the Damascus Road the scales had fallen from his eyes. And oh, there were scales on her eyes, and would they ever be shaken free? The only sound in the room was the tick of her wind-up west clocks and her low muttering voice. Show me my sin, Lord. I don't know. I know I've gone and missed something you meant for me to see. I can't sleep. I can't take a crap, and I don't feel you, Lord. I feel like I'm praying into a dead phone, and this is a bad time for that to happen. How have I offended thee? I'm listening, Lord. Listening for the still, small voice in my heart. And she did listen, but all was dark, dark like her skin, dark like the fallow earth that waits for the good seed. Please, my Lord, please, my Lord. But the image that rose was of a lonely stretch of dirt road in a sea of corn. There was a woman with a gunny sack full of freshly killed chickens, and the weasels came. They darted forward and made snatches at the bag. They could smell the blood, the old blood of sin and the fresh blood of sacrifice. She heard the old woman raise her voice to God, but her tone was weak and whining, a petulant voice, not begging humbly that God's will be done, but demanding that God save her so she could finish the work, her work, as if she knew the mind of God and could suborn his will to hers. The weasels grew bolder still. The croaker sack began to fray as they twitched and pulled it. Her fingers were too old, too weak. And when the chickens were gone, the weasels would come for her. They would... And then the weasels were scattering, running squeaking into the night, and she thought exultantly, God has saved me after all. Praise his name. God has saved his good and faithful servant. Not God, old woman. Me. In her vision, she turned, fear leaping hotly into her throat with a taste like fresh copper. And there, shouldering its way out of the corn like a ragged silver ghost, was a huge Rocky Mountain timber wolf, its jaws hanging open in a sardonic grin, its eyes burning. There was a beaten silver collar around its thick neck, a thing of handsome, barbarous beauty, and from it dangled a small stone of blackest jet, and in the center was a small red flaw, like an eye or a key. She crossed herself and forked the sign of the evil eye at this dreadful apparition. But its jaws only grinned wider, and between them lolled the naked pink muscle of its tongue. I'm coming for you, Mother. Not now, but soon. We'll run you like dogs run deer. I am all the things you think, but I'm more. I'm the magic man. I'm the man who speaks for the latter age. Your own people know me best, Mother. They call me John the Conqueror. Go, leave me in the name of the Lord God Almighty. But she was so terrified, not for the people around her, but for herself. She was afraid in her soul, afraid for her soul. Your God has no power over me, Mother. His vessel is weak. No, not true. My strength is the strength of 10. I shall mount up with wings as eagles. But the wolf only grinned and drew closer. She shrank from its breath, which was heavy and savage. This was the terror at noonday and the terror which flieth at midnight, and she was afraid.
She was in her extremity of fear, and the wolf, still grinning, began to speak in two voices, asking and then answering itself. "Who brought water from the rock when we were thirsty?" "I did," the wolf answered in a petulant, half-crowing, half-cowering voice. "Who saved us when we did faint?" asked the grinning wolf, its muzzle now only bare inches from her, its breath that of a living abattoir. "I did," the whining voice answered. "What must we do then, O giver of water?" "Praise my name," the wolf whined, drawing closer still, its grinning muzzle full of sharp death, its eyes red and haughty. "Oh, fall down and praise my name. I am the bringer of water in the desert. Praise my name. I am the good and faithful servant who brings water in the desert, and my name is also the name of my master." The mouth of the wolf opened wide to swallow her. "My name," she muttered. "Praise my name. Praise God from whom all blessings flow. Praise him, ye creatures here below." She raised her head and looked around the room in a kind of stupor. Her Bible had fallen to the floor. There was dawnlight in the eastward-facing window. "Oh, my Lord," she cried in a great and quavering voice, "who brought water from the rock when we were thirsty?" Was that it? Dear God, was that it? Was that why the scales had covered her eyes, making her blind to the things she should know? Bitter tears began to fall from her eyes, and she got slowly and painfully to her feet and walked to the window. Arthritis jabbed blunt darning needles into the joints of her hips and knees. She looked out and knew what she had to do now. She went back to the closet and pulled the white cotton nightgown over her head. She dropped it to the floor. Now she stood naked, revealing a body so lapped with wrinkles that it might have been the bed of time's great river. "Thy will be done," she said, and began to dress. An hour later, she was walking slowly west on Mapleton Avenue toward the wooded tangles and narrow-throated defiles beyond town. Stu was up at the power plant with Nick when Glenn burst in. Without preamble, he said, "Mother Abigail, she's gone." Nick looked at him sharply. "What are you talking about?" Stu asked, at the same time drawing Glenn away from the crew wrapping copper wire on one of the blown turbines. Glenn nodded. He had ridden a bike the 5 miles out here, and he was still trying to catch his breath. "I went over to tell her a little about the meeting last night. I wanted to do it early because Ralph said there's another 2 parties coming in today, and you know she likes to greet them. I went over around 8:30. She didn't answer my knock, so I went on in. I thought if she was asleep, I'd just leave, but I wanted to make sure she wasn't dead or anything. She's so old." Nick's gaze never left Glenn's lips. "But she wasn't there at all, and I found this on her pillow." He handed them a paper towel. Written on it was, "I must be gone a bit now. I've sinned and presumed to know the mind of God. My sin has been pride, and he wants me to find my place in his work again. I will be with you again soon, if it is God's will. Abby Freemantle." "I'll be a son of a bitch," Stu said. "What do we do now, Nick?" Nick read the note again. He handed it back to Glenn. "I guess we'll have to move up that meeting to tonight," Glenn said. Nick shook his head. He took out his pad, wrote, tore it off, and handed it to Glenn. Stu read it over his shoulder. "Man proposes, God disposes. Mother A was fond of that one, used to quote it frequently. Glenn, you yourself said she was other-directed. God or her own mind or her delusions or whatever. What's to do? She's gone. We can't change that." "But the uproar," Stu began. "Sure there's going to be an uproar," Glenn said. "Nick, shouldn't we at least have a meeting of the committee and discuss it?" Nick jotted. "What purpose? Why have a meeting that can't accomplish anything?" "Well, we should get up a search party. She can't have gone far." Nick double-circled the phrase, "Man proposes, God disposes." Below it he wrote, "If you found her, how would you bring her back? Chains?" "Jesus, no," Stu exclaimed. "But we can't just let her wander around, Nick.
She's got some crazy idea she's offended God. What if she feels like she has to go off into the friggin' wilderness like some Old Testament guy?
Nick wrote, I'm almost positive that's just what she's done.
Well, there you go.
Glenn put a hand on Stu's arm.
Now slow down a minute, East Texas. Let's look at the implications of this. To hell with the implications. I don't see no implications in leaving an old woman to wander around day and night until she dies of exposure.
She is not just any old woman. She is Mother Abigail, and around here she's the Pope. If the Pope decides he has to walk to Jerusalem, do you argue with him if you're a good Catholic?
God damn it, it's not the same thing, and you know it.
Yes, it is the same thing, it is. At least that's how the people in the free zone are going to see it. Stu, are you prepared to say for sure that God didn't tell her to go out into the bushes?
No, but...
Nick had been writing, and now he showed the paper to Stu, who had to puzzle over some of the words. Nick's handwriting was usually impeccable, but this was hurried, perhaps impatient. Stu, this changes nothing, except that it will probably hurt the Free Zone's morale. Not even sure that will happen. People aren't going to scatter just because she's gone. It does mean we won't have to clear our plans with her right now. Maybe that's best.
I'm going crazy, Stu said.
Sometimes we talk about her as an obstacle to get around like she was a roadblock. Sometimes you talk about her like the Pope, like she couldn't do anything wrong if she wanted to. And it just so happens that I like her. What do you want, Nicky? Someone stumbling over her body this fall in one of those box canyons west of town? You want us to leave her out there so she can make a holy meal for the crows?
Stu, Glenn said gently, it was her decision to go.
Oh, God damn, what a mess, Stu said.
By noon, the news of Mother Abigail's disappearance had swept the community. As Nick had predicted, the general feeling was more one of unhappy resignation than alarm. The sense of the community was that she might have gone off to pray for guidance so she could help them pick the right path to follow at the mass meeting on the 18th.
I don't want to blaspheme by calling her God, Glenn said over a scratch lunch in the park, but she is sort of a god by proxy. You can measure the strength of any society's faith by seeing how much that faith weakens when its empiric object is removed. These people are perfectly certain Mother Abigail is going to come back. Have you talked to them?
Yeah, Stu said. I can't believe it. There's an old woman wandering around out there, and everyone says, ho-hum, I wonder if she'll bring back the Ten Commandments on stone tablets in time for the meeting.
Maybe she will, Glenn said somberly. Anyway, not everyone is saying ho-hum. Ralph Brentner is practically tearing his hair out by the roots.
Good for Ralph. He looked at Glenn closely. What about you, Baldy? Where are you at in all this?
I wish you wouldn't call me that. It's not at all dignified. But I'll tell you, it's a little bit funny. Old East Texas turns out to be a lot more immune from the God spell she's cast over this community than the agnostic old bear sociologist. I think she'll be back. Somehow I just do. What does Franny think of all this?
I don't know. I haven't seen her at all this morning. For all I know, she's out there eating locusts and wild honey with Mother Abigail.
He stared at the flat irons, rising high in the blue haze of early afternoon.
Jesus, Glenn, I hope that old lady is all right.
Fran didn't even know Mother Abigail was gone. She had spent the morning at the library, which was by no means empty. She saw two or three people with books on farming, a bespectacled young man of about 25 poring over a book called Seven Independent Power Sources for Your Home, and a pretty blonde girl of about 14 with a battered paperback titled 600 Simple Recipes. She left the library around noon and strolled down to Walnut Street. She was halfway home when she met Shirley Hammett, the older woman that had been traveling with Dana, Susan, and Patty Kroger. Shirley had improved strikingly since then. Now she looked like a brisk and pretty matron about town. She stopped and greeted Fran.
When do you think she'll be back? I've been asking everybody. If this town had a newspaper, I'd write it up for the people poll. Like, what do you think of Senator Bunghole's stand on oil depletion? That sort of thing.
When who will be back?
Mother Abigail, of course. Where have you been, girl? Cold storage? What is all this? Franny asked, alarmed. So Shirley told Fran what had been going on while Fran had been at the library. Shirley was on her way downtown, and they parted. Fran hurried toward the apartment, wanting to see if Stu knew anything else. Coming so soon after their meeting last night, the old woman's disappearance struck her around the heart with a kind of superstitious dread. She didn't like not being able to pass on their major decisions, like the one to send people west, to Mother Abigail for judgment. With her gone, she felt too much of the responsibility on her own shoulders. When she got home, the apartment was empty. She had missed Stu by about 15 minutes. The note under the sugar bowl said simply, "Back by 9:30. I'm with Ralph and Harold. No worry, Stu." Ralph and Harold, she thought, and felt a sudden twinge of dread that had nothing to do with Mother Abigail. Now why should I be afraid for Stu? My God, if it came to that, Stu would tear him apart, unless Harold sneaked up behind him or something and... She clutched at her elbows, feeling cold, wondering what Stu could be doing with Ralph and Harold. 9:30 was hours away. She frowned down at her knapsack, which she had put on the counter, and thought that unless Stu and Ralph were at Harold's house, the place would be deserted until 9:30 tonight. And of course, if they were there, she could join them and satisfy her curiosity. She could bike out there in no time. If no one was there, she might find something that would set her mind at rest. But she wouldn't let herself think about that. Then what? The interior voice nagged. She didn't know. No worry, Stu. But there was worry. That thumbprint meant there was worry. Because a man who would steal your diary and pilfer your thoughts was a man without much principle or scruple. A man like that might creep up behind someone he hated and give a push off a high place, or use a rock, or a knife, or a gun. No worry, Stu. But if Harold did a thing like that, he would be through in Boulder. What could he do then? But Fran knew what then. She didn't know if Harold was the sort of man she had hypothesized. Not yet, not for sure. But she knew in her heart that there was a place for people like that now. Oh, yes, indeedy. She put her knapsack back on with quick little jerks and went out the door. 3 minutes later, she was biking up Broadway toward Arapahoe in the bright afternoon sunshine, thinking, "They'll be right in Harold's living room, drinking coffee and talking about Mother Abigail, and everybody will be fine. Just fine." But Harold's small house was dark, deserted, and locked. That in itself was something of a freak in Boulder. In the old days, you locked up when you went out so no one would steal your TV, stereo, your wife's jewels. But now the stereos and TVs were free. Much good they would do you with no juice to run them. And as for jewels, you could go to Denver and pick up a sackful any old time. Why do you lock your door, Harold, when everything's free? Because nobody is as afraid of robbery as a thief? Could that be it? She was no lockpicker. She had resigned herself to leaving when it occurred to her to try the cellar windows. They were set just above ground level, opaque with dirt. The first one she tried slid open sideways on its track, giving way grudgingly and sifting dirt down onto the basement floor. Fran looked around, but the world was quiet. No one except Harold had settled in this far out on Arapahoe as yet. That was odd, too. Harold could grin until his face cracked and slap people on the back and pass the time of day with folks. He could and did gladly offer his help whenever it was asked for, and sometimes when it wasn't. He could and did make people like him, and it was a fact that he was highly regarded in Boulder. But where he had chosen to live, that was something else now, wasn't it? She wriggled in the window, getting her blouse dirty, and dropped to the floor. Now the cellar window was on a level with her eyes. She was no more a gymnast than she was a lockpicker, and she would have to stand on something to get back out. Fran looked around. The basement had been finished off into a playroom rumpus room, the kind of thing her own dad had always talked about but never quite got around to doing, she thought with a little pang of sadness. The walls were knotty pine with quadraphonic speakers embedded in them. There was an Armstrong suspended ceiling overhead, a large case filled with jigsaw puzzles and books, an electric train set, a slot car racing set. There was also an air hockey game on which Harold had indifferently set a case of Coke. It had been the kids' room, and posters dotted the walls. The biggest showed President Carter coming out of the Plains Baptist Church, hands raised high, a big grin on his face, revealing all 860 teeth. The caption in huge red letters said, "You don't want to lay no boogie-woogie on the king of rock and roll." She suddenly felt sadder than she had since she couldn't remember, to tell the truth. She had been through shocks and fear and outright terror and a perfect numbing savagery of grief. But this deep and aching sadness was something new. With it came a sudden wave of homesickness for a Gunquit, for the ocean, for the good Maine hills and pines. What was she doing here, poised between the plains and the mountains that broke the country in two? It wasn't her place. She didn't belong here. One sob escaped her, and it sounded so terrified and lonely that she clapped both hands over her mouth for the second time that day. "No more, Franny, old kid, old sock. You don't get over anything this big so quickly, a little at a time. If you have to have a cry, have it later, not here in Harold Lauder's basement. Business first." She walked past the poster on her way to the stairs, and a bitter little smile crossed her face as she passed Jimmy Carter's grinning cinemascope face. "They sure laid some boogie-woogie on you," she thought. "Someone did." The door giving on the kitchen at the top of the cellar stairs was unlocked. The kitchen was neat and ship-shape, the luncheon dishes done up and drying in the drainer, the little Coleman gas stove washed off and sparkling. But a greasy smell of frying still hung in the air, like a ghost of Harold's old self. Nothing here. She went into the living room. It was dark, so dark it made her uneasy. Harold not only kept his doors locked, he kept his shades pulled. That was more than strange. It was weird. The living room, like the kitchen, was astringently neat, but the furniture was stodgy and a little seedy-looking. The room's nicest feature was the fireplace, a huge stone job with a hearth wide enough to sit on. She did sit down for a moment, looking around thoughtfully. As she shifted, she felt a loose hearthstone under her fanny, and she was about to get up and look at it when someone knocked on the door. Fear drifted down on her like a smothering weight of feathers. She was paralyzed with sudden terror. Her breath stopped, and she would not be aware until later that she had wet herself a little. The knock came again, half a dozen quick, firm raps. "My God," she thought. "The shades are down at least, thank heaven for that." That thought was followed by a sudden cold certainty that she had left her bike out where anyone could see it. Had she? She tried desperately to think, but for a long moment she could summon nothing to mind except a babble of gibberish that was unsettlingly familiar. "Before removing the mote from thy neighbor's eye, remove the pie from thine own." The knock came again, and a woman's voice. "Anybody home?" Fran sat stock still. She suddenly remembered that she had parked her bike around back, under Harold's clothesline, not visible from the front of the house, but if Harold's visitor decided to try the back door... The knob of the front door, Franny could see it down the short length of hall, began to turn back and forth in half circles. "Whoever she is, I hope she's no better at locks than I am," Franny thought, and then had to squeeze both hands over her mouth to stop an insane bray of laughter. That was when she looked down at her cotton slacks and saw how badly she'd been frightened. "At least she didn't scare the shit out of me," Fran thought, and the laughter bubbled again, hysterical and frightened, just below the surface. Then, with an indescribable sense of relief, she heard footfalls clicking away from the door and down Harold's concrete path. Fran ran quietly down the hall to the front door and put her eye to the small crack between the shade and the edge of the window. She saw a woman with long, dark hair that was streaked with white. She climbed onto a small Vespa motor scooter that was parked at the curb. As the motor burped into life, she tossed her hair back and clipped it. "It's the cross woman, the one who came over with Larry Underwood. Does she know Harold?" Nadine started off with a little jerk and was soon out of sight. Fran uttered a huge sigh, and her legs turned to water, She opened her mouth to let out the laugh that had been bubbling below the surface, knowing already how it would sound, shaky and relieved. Instead, she burst into tears. 5 minutes later, too nervous now to search any further, she was boosting herself back through the cellar window from the seat of a wicker chair she had pulled over. Once out, she was able to push the chair far enough so that it wouldn't be obvious someone had used it to climb out. It was still out of position, but people rarely noticed things like that. And it didn't even look as if Harold used the basement except to store his Coca-Cola. She reclosed the window and got her bike. She still felt weak and stunned from her scare. At least my pants are drying, she thought. Next time you go housebreaking, Francis Rebecca, remember to wear your continence pants. She pedaled out of Harold's yard and left Arapahoe as soon as she could, coming back into the downtown area on Canyon Boulevard. She was back in her own apartment 15 minutes later. The place was utterly silent. She opened her diary and looked down at the muddy chocolate fingerprint and wondered where Stu was. She wondered if Harold was with him. Oh, Stu, please come home. I need you. After lunch, Stu had left Glenn and had come home. He had been sitting blankly in the living room, wondering where Mother Abigail was, and also wondering if Nick and Glenn could possibly be right about just letting it be, when there was a knock. Stu? Ralph Brentner called. Hello, Stu, you home? Harold Lauder was with him. Harold's smile was muted today, but not entirely gone. He looked like a jolly mourner trying to be serious for the graveside service. Ralph, heartsick over Mother Abigail's disappearance, had met Harold half an hour ago, Harold being on his way home after helping with a water-hauling party at Boulder Creek. Ralph liked Harold, who always seemed to have time to listen and commiserate with whoever had a sad tale to tell. And Harold never seemed to want anything in return. Ralph had poured out the whole story of Mother Abigail's disappearance, including his fears that she might suffer a heart attack, or break one of her brittle bones, or die of exposure if she stayed out overnight. And you know it showers just about every damn afternoon, Ralph finished as Stu poured coffee. If she gets soaked, she'd be sure to take a cold. Then what? Pneumonia, I guess. What can we do about it? Stu asked. We can't force her to come back if she doesn't want to. Well, no, Ralph conceded. But Harold has a real good idea. Stu's eyes shifted. How you doing, Harold? Pretty good. You? Fine. And Fran? You watching out for her? Harold's eyes didn't waver from Stu's, and they kept their slightly humorous, pleasant light. But Stu had a momentary feeling that Harold's smiling eyes were like sunshine on the water of Breekman's Quarry back home. The water looked so pleasant, but it went down and down to black depths where the sun had never reached, and 4 boys had lost their lives in pleasant-looking Breekman's Quarry over the years. As best I can, he said. What's your thought, Harold? Well, look, I see Nick and Glenn's point. They recognize that the Free Zone sees her as a theocratic symbol, and they're pretty close to speaking for the Zone now, aren't they? Stu sipped his coffee. What do you mean, theocratic symbol? I'd call it an earthly symbol of a covenant made with God, Harold said, and his eyes veiled a little. Like Holy Communion or the Sacred Cows of India. Stu kindled a little at that. Yeah, pretty good. Those cows, they let them walk the streets and cause traffic jams, right? They can go in and out of the stores or decide to leave town altogether. Yes, Harold agreed. But most of those cows are sick, Stu. They're always near the point of starvation. Some are tubercular. And all because they're an aggregate symbol. The people are convinced God will take care of them, just as our people are convinced God will take care of Mother Abigail. But I have my own doubts about a God that says it's right to let a poor dumb cow wander around in pain. Ralph looked momentarily uncomfortable, and Stu knew what he was feeling. He felt it himself, and it gave him a measure of his feelings about Mother Abigail. He felt that Harold was edging into blasphemy. Anyway, Harold said briskly, dismissing the sacred cows of India, we can't change the way people feel about her. And wouldn't want to, Ralph added quickly. Right, Harold exclaimed. After all, she brought us together. but my idea was that we mount our trusty cycles and spend the afternoon reconnoitering the west side of Boulder. If we stay fairly close, we can keep in touch with each other by walkie-talkie. Stu was nodding. This was the sort of thing he had wanted to do all along. Sacred cows or not, God or not, it just wasn't right to leave her to wander around on her own. And if we find her, Harold said, we can ask her if she wants anything. Like a ride back to town, Ralph chipped in. At least we can keep tabs on her, Harold said. Okay, Stu said. I think it's a hell of a good idea, Harold. Just let me leave a note for Fran. Harold had asked for and gotten a twisting stretch of road between Boulder and Nederland because he considered it to be the least likely area. He didn't think he could walk from Boulder to Nederland in one day, let alone that crazy old cunt, but it made a pleasant ride and gave him a chance to think. Now at 6:45, he was on his way back. His Honda was parked in a rest area, and he was sitting at a picnic table, having a Coke and a few Slim Jims. The walkie-talkie that hung over the Honda's handlebars crackled faintly with Ralph Brentner's voice. Sunrise Amphitheater. No sign of her. Storm's over up here. Then Stu's voice, stronger and closer. He was in Chautauqua Park, only 4 miles from Harold's location. Say again, Ralph? Ralph's voice came again, really bellowing. Maybe he would give himself a stroke. That would be a lovely way to end the day. No sign of her up here. I'm coming down before it gets dark. Over. 10-4, Stu said, sounding discouraged. Harold, are you there? Harold got up, wiping Slim Jim grease on his jeans. Harold, calling Harold Lauder. You copy, Harold? Harold pointed his middle finger, your fuck finger, as the high school Neanderthals back in a gun quit had called it, at the walkie-talkie. Then he depressed the talk button and said pleasantly, but with just the right note of discouragement, I'm here. I was off to one side. I thought I saw something down in the ditch. It was just an old jacket. Over. Yeah, okay. Why don't you come down to Chautauqua, Harold? We'll wait there for Ralph. Love to give orders, don't you, suckhole? I might have something for you. Yes, I just might. Harold, you copy? Sorry, I was wool gathering. I can be there in 15 minutes. You copying this, Ralph? Stu bellowed, making Harold wince. He gave Stu's voice the finger again, grinning furtively as he did so. I'm on my way, Ralph's voice came faintly through the roar of static. Over and out. Harold turned off the walkie-talkie, collapsed the antenna, and hung the radio on the handlebars again. But he sat astride the Honda for a moment without operating the Kickstarter.